Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. There the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Monks, I shall teach you an exposition of non-conflict. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. One should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana. One should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. And knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach and speak only the Dhamma. One should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. One should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter sharp, overt speech. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. One should not insist on local usage of language, and one should not override normal local usage of language. This is the summary of the exposition of non-conflict. One should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires is a state without suffering, without vexation, without despair, and without fever, and it is the right way. The pursuit of self-mortification, painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of self-mortification is a state without suffering, without vexation, without despair, without fever, and it is the right way. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to Nibbana. It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. One should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage, and knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage. How, monks, does there come to be extolling and disparaging, and failure to teach and speak only the Dhamma? When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of sensual pleasures, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, one extols some. When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. When one says, all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those who have abandoned the fetter of being are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. This is how there comes to be extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma. And how, monks, does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dhamma? When one does not say, all those engaged in the pursuit of enjoyment whose pleasure is linked to sensuality have entered upon the wrong way, but instead say, the pursuit of sensuality is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. When one speaks this way, one teaches and speaks only the Dhamma. When one does not say, all those engaged in the pursuit of self-mortification have entered upon the wrong way, but they say instead, the pursuit of self-mortification is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one says, all of those who are disengaged from the pursuit of sensual pleasure have entered upon the right way, but instead says, the disengagement from the pursuit of sensual pleasure is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way, then one speaks only the Dhamma. When one says, all of those who have not abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the wrong way, but instead says, as long as the fetter of being is unabandoned, being too is unabandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say, all those who have abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the right way, but says instead, when the fetter of being is abandoned, being is also abandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one speaks truthfully about the phenomena that is occurring, the conduct, and leaves out the doer of the conduct, when one doesn't attach a label to a being, but instead speaks only of the conduct, then one is speaking rightly. This is why I said earlier, with regard to the Pulula Panyati, the knowledge about people, where it says that some people are ill-will people, some people are sensual desire, lustful, greedy people, some people are confused, that these are their karmic tendencies, even their habitual tendencies. I try not to consign people to those labels precisely for this reason. We're constantly in motion, we're constantly changing. To assign any definite personality trait to yourself is a sure path to suffering. It's not to say that it's an illusion. If you assign a label to yourself and others, it is real. See, this is the problem when we try and speak of the Dhamma as getting to reality and discarding illusion. That's true, but we tend to think that reality is efficacious and illusion is not. Illusion has just as much power as, quote, reality does. If we believe the labels that we have attached to ourselves and believe the labels that we have attached to others, very real action happens on that basis in this world. Maybe you've noticed. But if we speak only of action, which arises and passes away, then there's no need for labels. There's just need for speaking of the truth about the moment, letting it go, and then looking at the world with fresh eyes, giving other people the space, the freedom, the respect, the loving kindness to change and to reveal through their next action who they are in that moment. It's very difficult to afford people that sovereignty because we are pattern-seeking creatures. And we like to get people's number. And we like somebody who can tell us what our number is. It gives us a sense of relief. Why? Because if somebody has us figured out, then we are really here. Then we really exist. There is an essence to us. There is a core to us. There is this person. Somebody may say something to you, and it may resonate, oh, you know, I've always been this way. Well, isn't that true? No, it's not true. It's a fancy that you have now, that you've always been this way, and it gives you pleasure, and that's why you say, yes, that's true, that's always been me. It's an ear contact, and then your mind deciphers what the ear contact is and takes pleasure in it. You know, you're basically a good person. Well, you may be good now because your action is good now, but if you don't maintain that good action, maybe in the next moment, there won't be good action there. But we love hearing the label. We do. It supports our craving to be. It supports our craving to be pleasantly. One should know how to define pleasure. And knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? Monks, there are these five chords of sensual pleasure. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. There are these sounds cognizable by the ear that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. There are these odors cognizable by the nose that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. There are these flavors cognizable by the tongue that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. There are these tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, and agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five chords of sensual pleasure. Now the pleasure and joy that arise dependent upon the five chords of sensual pleasure are called sensual pleasures. And listen to the language. A filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, that it should not be developed, that it should not be cultivated, and that it should be feared. This is very strong language, very strong language. We're always in a state of development. This is the danger. If we have feeling, a pleasant feeling, and we let that feeling arise and pass away without relishing in it and delighting in it, fine. It's okay that they served pancakes this morning. I wish that it was real maple syrup. Maybe we can talk to Jordan. That would be more pleasurable and certainly provocative of lust. But the problem is when the pleasant sensation lingers with us and we turn it over in the mind, what we are doing is we are shaping our becoming. If I had in front of me the wheel of dependent origination, this would become very clear. You have contact. Let's stay with pancakes. We have contact at the tongue. It produces, I assume for everybody that likes pancakes, a pleasant feeling. And we say pleasant tongue feeling. And then we crave the pancakes. What happens then is that we cling to this enjoyment of the pancake and we become a pancake eater. This is the next step. This is bhava becoming, arises after clinging. This is sometimes translated as habitual tendency, which would be, I always like pancakes. But I really do like this bhava because this is how beings take on the body. The human being is unique in that the human being can take on all kinds of different bodies. It can take on a sensual body. And in meditation, it can take on a form body, a blissful form body in the jhanas. It can take on an arupa, a non-formal body in the arupa states, the immaterial states. So this becoming is very much dependent on what we're relishing. We literally fashion, which is a translation of sankhara, we fashion a body for ourselves to match our desire. This is how intention affects matter. This is how intention affects form. For those of you that might consider that to be a little too much to believe, think of this. If you look into the hillside in front of this retreat center, you see checkerboard patterns happening in the hillsides. That's because agriculture is happening. That agriculture began as a mental intention, did it not? And then somebody had a mental intention to make agriculture easier, and so they invented the plow and the tractor, and then we make it run on gas. This all begins with mental intention, and the mental intention organizes materiality and has an effect upon materiality. We see mental intention affecting and directing and recombining materiality more and more. Why is it such a leap of faith to think that mental intention organizes our own bodies? So mental intention is very important. And when mental intention is dominated by sensuality, we bind ourselves to the kama loka. We bind ourselves to having a physical body, which is lovely when we're young. The Buddha talks about the three intoxications. The first is the intoxication with youth. And part of the intoxication of youth is, even though we intellectually know we're going to get older, we look out into the room, if we're young, at the people who are older, and we say, that's never going to happen to me. The second one is intoxication with health. When the body is working well, has no major problems, no aches and pains, we don't have any spinal compression, so we can sit on the floor very easily and sit in, with our spine straight in meditation, not too many aches and pains. And we think it's going to be like that again forever. We know other people get sick. We see other people get sick. But our heart says, that'll never happen to me. And then we see the intoxication with life. Other people die. We don't. And all of us who are not arhants fully awakened, enlightened right now, in our hearts, we need to recognize that we are denying the reality of our death. That's why the Buddha advised us in the five daily recollections to be mindful of death. Mindfulness of death, a very powerful practice, one that everyone needs to engage in because it's going to happen. So when we allow ourselves to become besotted by sensuality, it covers over the reality of aging, sickness, and death. It covers over the reality that it is shaping our destiny and shaping our very bodies. And if we would not like to have a body next time, if there's going to be a next time, if we would like to not have a body, which is like a train heading towards a brick wall, it's wonderful in its energy in the beginning, we're going somewhere, and then the brick wall, we smash into it. This is not advantageous to have a physical body. The reason why it's advantageous to be a human is because we can experience ranges outside of the physical body, but we are the only physical beings who can do that. So the Buddha then responds to sensual pleasures in this way. Here, monks, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, in the second jhana, in the third jhana, in the fourth jhana. Now, we're going to talk about these jhanas over the next few days, but this is the response to sensual pleasure. The Buddha says of the jhanas, these are called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, sambodhi sukham, the bliss of enlightenment. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, and that it should not be feared. What is the Buddha saying here? He's saying the jhanas are the middle way. We think that the middle way is a path of moderation. We think that we have the extreme of sensual enjoyment, we have the extreme of mortification. And we think that somewhere in the middle is just eat your dinner without being attached. It's more than that. Of course, moderation is part of the practice, Again, the phrase is used in the gradual training with regard to eating, where eating is to be used to quell sensations of hunger without arousing new sensations. That's the Buddha's definition of moderation, to allay pain without arousing pleasure, unless it's the jhanas. That pleasure is to be cultivated, is to be pursued, is not to be feared. Any questions before I go on? Yes.
Can you speak a little bit more about why pleasure from like jhanas or piti is like more somehow special and different? Mm-hmm. Like it's like a very reductionist materialist view of it, but like I would think like pleasure is pleasure. Mm-hmm. Like even like piti subsides, it kind of mellows out. Mm-hmm. So does like metta mellows out too. Mm-hmm. So it feels like it's kind of like a same but different type of thing. Why is it like fundamentally
because it's not addictive, because it's onward leading, because, well, let's be honest, how many of us, when we get off retreat and even in the beginning of the retreat, are running to the cushion? There takes a certain amount of effort to sit, even though it's pleasurable, but we're running to the lunch bell, you see? And so what the pleasure of the jhanas do, and I'll talk about this in greater detail, is the pleasure of the jhanas satisfy our pursuit of pleasure. Things that don't satisfy the pursuit of pleasure leave us wanting more pleasure. These truly fulfill. They fulfill the desire for pleasure. Nothing else fulfills the desire for pleasure. Everything else is a creditor. They want payment with interest.
What's the name of this sutta?
This is the Aranya Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of non-conflict, Majjhima Nikaya number 139. Mm-hmm. Okay. One should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt, sharp speech, so it was said, with reference to what was this said. Raho, covert speech. Raho means secret, behind one's back. What is the Buddha saying here? Anything that you can say about another person, you should be able to say it in front of them. Pretty clear. Now, there are further rules for speech, so keep that in mind. One should not speak behind others' backs, but there are rules about whether one should speak in front of another person. When it's time to speak, when it's proper. Here, monks, when one knows covert speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should know of no account utter it. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. But when one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the correct time to do so. Here, monks, when one knows overt, sharp speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should of no account utter it. When one knows overt, sharp speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. When one knows overt, sharp speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the right time to do so. So, there is a time when one can speak about another, but it has to be true, it has to be beneficial, and it has to be at the right time. Thinking maybe of an intervention with somebody who's really suffering, and maybe one knows that directly approaching the person may not be in their best interests. Maybe one knows another person who knows this person better, knows when the right time would be for this person. So you could approach that person and say, this person appears to be in trouble. How would you approach this person so the person would have an open heart? Speech has, as you can see, rules. If the speech that you want to utter is untrue and unbeneficial, don't say it. If the speech that you want to utter is untrue and beneficial, don't say it, because it's a lie. If the speech that you want to utter is true but unbeneficial, don't say it. This would be, you know, being overly candid. It's okay to remain silent. Unless, of course, you're called to a court and you have to raise your hand and say, now declare what you know, then you have to declare what you know. You can't omit. That's actually in the suttas. That's not from my legal career. But I would advise you to say what you know. Finally, if the speech that you are considering uttering is true and beneficial, find the right time. And this is what's important. This involves a measure of compassion. If you would know the mind of others, know your own mind. Try to put yourself in the situation of the person and think to yourself, try to feel that person through their body language, through how they're relating to you. And this is aided by the practice of the Brahma Viharas, to be able to encompass the mind of others, to be able to read their emotions, to be able to actually feel what they're feeling. Ask yourself, would I be ready for this true and beneficial speech in this frame of mind? And if the answer is no, not ready, don't say it. Speech should go to the heart when it's right speech, when it's perfected speech. It should go to the heart. It should be disarming. It should be sweet. It should be received sweetly. It should bring people together rather than dividing. It should resolve conflict as opposed to creating conflict. These are the Buddha's guidelines on speech, and such important guidelines, because when we think about our world and our lives, so much of it depends on speech. Gone are the days when most of our lives were done in with physical labor and silence. Most of our lives involve speaking to others, sending emails, sending text messages, making phone calls. And I noticed that Gmail developed this feature where you could unsend an email. It only lasts for like 5 seconds. You have the choice. But after 5 seconds, it's sent. But you can unsend some of these emails. And that's such a testament to the fact that we are speaking hurriedly, which we're about to address, and not processing what we want to say through the rules of speech that the Buddha has given in this sutta. We should remember these rules. Remember that ill will has a honeyed tip. The flower and the leaf is honeyed, but a poisoned root. It has a taste to it of sweetness. To really say what you want and to say it sharply, it's not enough to be brilliant. It's not enough to really get the right precise word in there and to really cut. One should not cut. One should be truthful, but be truthful in a way that disarms the other person, that disarms their emotions, that causes them to grow, that causes them to feel warm inside, that causes them to feel your care, and that you're speaking from a place of care and not a place of criticism. This is a practice, not a perfection. We're all trying as best as we can. We're all going to act inconsistently. That's why this is a practice. We just have to remind ourselves what to do over and over again, and say, all right, I missed it this time. Recognize, change, no blame. Move on.
Last year I learned from Dowson this line. He says, think before you speak. And mm-hmm. The acronym for think, it's THINK. So T for timeliness, is it the correct time to say it? Mm-hmm. H for honesty, so whatever you say, be sure it's honest. I is for intention. What is your intention in trying to say that? And N is for necessary. Is it really necessary for you to say at this moment? And K is for kindly. If you have to say it kindly. So I thought it's really nice to say think before you speak.
It's a wonderful acronym.
That's from Nelson.
Yes, great. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly, so it was said, and with reference to what was this said. Here, monks, when one speaks hurriedly, one's body grows tired, and one's mind becomes excited. One's voice is strained, and one's throat becomes hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is indistinct and hard to understand. Here, monks, when one speaks unhurriedly, one's body does not grow tired, nor does one's mind become excited. One's voice is not strained, nor does one's throat become hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is distinct and easy to understand. One should not insist on local language, and one should not override normal usage. How, monks, does there come to be the insistence on local language and the overriding of normal usage? Here, monks in different localities, they call the same thing a dish. And their Pali word is given pati, a bowl, pata, a vessel, vita, a saucer, sarava, a pan, daropa, a pot, ponya, a basin, pisila. All the same kind of concave object, right? So whatever they call it in such and such locality, one speaks accordingly, firmly adhering to that expression and insisting, only this is correct, anything else is wrong. This is how there comes to be insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage. And how, monks, does there come to be the non-insistence on local language and the non-overriding of normal usage? Here, monks, in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, and then the various things, a vessel, a bowl, a saucer, a pan, a basin. So whatever they call it in such a locality, without adhering to that expression, one speaks accordingly, thinking, these monks, these venerable ones, it seems, are speaking with reference to this. This is how there comes to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage. So if you know what's being spoken about, the fact that the word, the same word is not being used, the fact that you're not saying the same word, oh, I've had several students come up to me and say, isn't it vijnana? It really goes up my spine when you say vijnana, consciousness, right? Isn't it bhava and not bhava? Well, the V in Pali is a semi-liquid vowel labial, which we don't really have in English. It's not a V, it's not a W, it's a W. It's a combination of both. Bawa, right? So there's a short coming together of the labial, and then there's an aspiration. Doesn't matter. Speak your Pali with an English accent. It's just fine. Most of us are reading Pali with a Romanized alphabet, which was not the original alphabet. Even if we're reading Pali in the Sinhalese alphabet, that wasn't the original alphabet. So the Sri Lankans claim a special ownership of Pali because Pali was first written in the Sinhalese alphabet. And so the Sinhalese pronunciation of Pali tends to be thought of as the correct pronunciation of Pali. But Pali, of course, is a North Indian Prakrit language, not a Sinhalese language originally. So even that is just an approximation. Bhava, bhava, we know what we mean. And then the Buddha recapitulates the sutta. Therefore, monks, you should train yourselves thus. We shall know the state with conflict, and we shall know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we shall enter upon the way without conflict. Now, monks, Subhuti is a clansman who has entered upon the way without conflict. This was actually given to the monk Subhuti, who is actually the protagonist in a later sutta, Mahayana Sutra, the Diamond Sutra. Here, Subhuti was said to have a problem with conflict, with anger. And on hearing this sutta, it is said that he had entered upon the way of non-conflict. This is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Any comments or questions?
I think joyful and easy, but still so hard to get out of bed. And I keep trying to remind myself, just get up, because it's so wonderful. And I felt like maybe it was karmic forces. And I think the sutta spoke of this.
Yes. Well, I think you are illustrating the answer to the early question about why this pleasure is different. The pleasure of meditation, the pleasure of jhana, is different from other pleasures. Sleep is a pleasure, and it's a sensual pleasure. And so it's hard to get out of bed because sensual pleasures are addictive. If the pleasure of the meditation were addictive, and the pleasure of the meditation is greater than the pleasure of sensual pleasures, you would be running to the cushion. You would choose the meditation over the sleep, right? But you don't choose the meditation over the sleep, which shows again the danger of sensual pleasure and the fact that the pleasures of the meditation are not addictive. They don't leave the hangover of wanting more. Mm-hmm. I'll speak at greater length about this, but the jhanas are so unique on the spiritual path, the way that the Buddha articulated them and articulated their elements, their factors, and articulated why they're needed on the path is very unique. We need this pleasure because we have to train the heart. As I've said earlier, you can't think your way out of your emotions. You can't tell yourself to not feel a certain way. What you have to do is you have to calm yourself, and then you may feel differently. Now, we say to a child who didn't get the toy that they want, or let's say a piece of candy, right? A child wants a piece of candy. We know rationally that if the child eats the piece of candy, they're not gonna eat their dinner, or you know, they're not gonna eat whatever's next, vegetables, which they don't want to eat, right? So the child has a meltdown. A child has you see the red coming up from the center, which is anger. You can see it so clearly in a child. And then it bursts into tears and starts crying. And you've rationally explained to the child, you need vegetables. This has the minerals that you need to live. Don't you want to continue living? No, the child doesn't want to continue living. It wants candy. So we know rationally, we have the mental exercise, but the child just doesn't listen. So what do you have to do? Take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. It's okay, breathe, it's okay. And we're doing the same thing to ourselves here. We just have maybe deeper existential emotions, right? But it's the same principle. We're using the jhanas to take a deep breath because things are impermanent. All things are not self. It's all up here in the brain. We have to convince ourselves. We have to train the emotions, and we have to do that in a way that doesn't involve language. Just bounces off of us, like, you're gonna die. Not me, everybody else, not me. Yes?
Can you comment a little bit on the word conflict in the sutta? I know that there was the piece about something being honest and timely and beneficial. And sometimes that brings about conflict in the relationship. If I'm saying something to somebody that does meet those criteria, but that then they're upset about it, or that then a conflict arises. Can you speak to that?
Well, the timeliness has to do with the receptivity of the person that you're speaking to. It doesn't have to do with the proximity of the event that you want to speak about. That's the some things can't be helped, you know. The house is on fire. You're gonna have to tell somebody, they'll have to have their freak out. But if we're talking about deep matters, right? Deep matters that have been building, that you're trying to find the words, then maybe the urgency isn't there to address it because the house isn't on fire. So there, the timeliness has to do not with how strong the feeling is in you. Then it would also be untimely, because if you speak with an unbalanced mind, then you're going to say things in the wrong way, and you're also, the person's going to pay attention to the emotion instead of the content of what you're saying. So timeliness involves your own emotional state and the emotional state of the person that you're talking to.
What if the other person isn't open to hearing?
Well, then you have to decide whether or not you're going to speak about it, whether it's worth it. If they're not open to hearing about it, it may be that you need to work on other strategies, nonverbal strategies, to make the person comfortable as they can be. But again, inevitably, you know, if the relationship needs to end and the person just is never going to be okay with hearing that, try for the best possible setting, for the best possible emotional constitution in yourself to say that from the most loving, compassionate place. Because there's fear in the person that speaks that way too, that this person's going to be emotional and cry and have a meltdown. And we don't want to see that because we don't want to take responsibility for that, right? So we're afraid. Well, that's our problem. So we have to be grown-ups. We have to say this is the consequence of attachment, to be very mindful of the suffering of others and the suffering of ourselves, to try and put us in a place that is the most loving and the most kind.
Could you please repeat the acronym, THINK?
I think Tin can do it better than I can, because I just heard it.
Yeah, so T for timeliness, H for honesty, I is for intention, N is for necessary, and K is for kind. What we say that it has to be true, beneficial, and the right time, can we meet one or two of those things? Because, you know, sometimes it's not the right time, but that's the only time you get to be with this person, and, you know, you won't see them 2-3 months later or whatever. Can you still say it anyway because you know it is true and it will benefit them, but you could not meet all the three criteria?
You should always entertain not speaking as an option. If it's something that you have to say to make yourself feel better, deal with it on your own.
Well, I think, you know, with the profession that I'm in, a lot of come for advice and whatever, and you don't see them again until 3 months later, and if you say it, you know, sometimes the time it might not be right, but there's a lot of time.
Right. You have to fulfill your standards of care. That is something that you've taken an oath to do, is to fulfill the standard of care. And I hope that the standard of care takes this timeliness and the most therapeutic time for the person to hear the truth into account in the standard. And if it doesn't, then maybe you can add that as a standard. But again, if you're up against it, and a worse outcome will happen to the person emotionally or physically if you don't speak, then that makes it the right time to speak.